Well, thank you. I appreciate you setting the bar very high as we start this day. I do like the comment he made about keeping it as simple as possible, because boy, are you in luck when you see my analysis. I'm oftentimes kind of the token economist in the room, and I like it that way because you're more fun to hang out with than economist, I can assure you. But what I've been asked to talk about is in this changing world of higher cost, particularly on the grain side, the hay side, we're all familiar with rising land prices and so on, but also higher prices for our beef, do the old rules apply of our breeding targets? And so that's what I'm going to try to talk to you about today. So just a quick overview, and kind of the two big things I'm going to touch on is our biofuel policy. I am from Iowa, so I have probably a little different perspective on biofuel policy than many of you, and I'm happy to talk about that, and I get to see both sides of it. Also talk about what's going on in the general economy in the U.S. and the global recession, and then what role does economics play in genetic selection? I'll be pretty brief on that because you guys have been at it for decades, and then try to get to that question of, do our old rules still apply in this new economic environment? I'll try to get back to Tom's question about where's the money, what can I do to help assure that I'm still here in a decade and still successful in a decade. So before I start, though, there's some things to remember about economists. First, we have a firm grasp of the obvious. There's no magic there, at least not in my economics, and but maybe I can provide some perspective to help you think through how that applies to your operation. Secondly, we're better at predicting history than we are the future. And you will see some of that as well, but what can we learn from the past to help us as we move forward? Let's start off and talk about the biofuel policy. A brief history lesson, if you will. The Energy Independence and Security Act was passed Congress in August of 2007, signed by President Bush December of 2007. And the key thing among that, and there is a lot, like all these languages, pages and pages of it, but the key thing that came out of it is what's called the Renewable Fuel Standard, or the RFS, that set a target and a timeline that the U.S. is to move forward on as it comes to renewable energy or biofuels specifically. The other thing to keep in mind is that the U.S. is one of more than 40 countries around the world pursuing ethanol and other biofuels. So it's not just the U.S., it is the world that is going down this path. Most of you have probably seen this picture. This is the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. We'll spend a little bit of time on it here. The bright green at the bottom is corn-based ethanol. And this is the target written into law of how many billion gallons a year we are to produce. This year, 2009, the target's just a little over 10 billion gallons. It ramps up to 2015 at 15 billion gallons, and then it stays there. If you look at the purple at the top, that's anything but corn-based ethanol, kind of including imports, ethanol from pond scum, whatever you can come up with. The yellow is biodiesel, mainly soy biodiesel, but it can be from animal fats. And why that's important with that carve-out, even though a thin line there, what it says is thou shall produce soybeans. So this idea of saying, let's take all the land we have and we'll just plant more corn and less soybeans, we now have a law on the other side that says, nope, we got to have biodiesel. Now, the blue line in there, the triangle, is cellulosic biofuels, cellulosic ethanol. That is the holy grail. That is what everybody is chasing. The genetics discussion we saw yesterday with the Bayesian and the molecular genetics, I would hypothesize there's several of those people, either them or their lab, that are working on the genetics of enzymes and microbes to convert cellulose to ethanol. So I'm going to talk about competition for the beef cattle from a feedstock standpoint. It could be competing on an intellectual standpoint as well as we chase this holy grail. Now, if you notice in that blue triangle that's there, by the time we get out to 2022, we're supposed to be producing 16 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol. If you notice down there at 2009, Well, let's just put it this way. We consumed more alcohol last night than we're making from cellulose right now. Okay? So it's a zero to a bunch in a short period of time. But that's our Holy Grail. That's what we're after. Now, as we stop back and look at this, in this study by colleagues of mine at Iowa State University at the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development modeled this in a 2005. Now, keep that number in mind, 2005. They said, you know, if we had $54 oil long-term, that the substitution rate of ethanol for gasoline, because it has about two-thirds the BTUs of gasoline, we would go to about 14.8 billion, about 15 billion gallons by 2011 if there were no restrictions, right, if the demand was there and so on. And to do that, we'd produce 94 million acres of corn, and we'd have an average corn price of $3.40. That's the new long-run equilibrium that they modeled. And everybody kind of looked at that and said, well, okay, so what? Well, the so what is that the following year, I think it was 2006, no, it was the 2007 crop, we produced 93 million acres of corn. Okay. Where are we today on the corn price? About $3.50. Now, theirs was not a forecast of today, but the point is, with $50 a barrel oil, about a $3.50 corn price is where we'll move to. Last summer at $147 for oil, everybody's thinking, oh man, you know, that's where we're going to be the rest of our lives. And now we're struggling. We got down in the low 40s and we're still bouncing 40 to 50. So the key thing there, and I'm going to come back to this, is the price of corn is tied to the price of ethanol, which is tied to the price of oil. And that's going to be the future that we look at going forward. The other thing that they found is that if oil goes to $64 a barrel and there are no bottlenecks, meaning people will buy the product, it's available, we have cars that can burn it, we could go to 112 million acres of corn and we could go to $4.40 on a corn price. Let's talk about cellulose, and this is my own clean back of the envelope I started with here. This is not any sophisticated model, but just a little sensitivity table. We look at tons per acre at 4, 6, or 8 tons of forage or biomass, if you will, per acre, and then a yield of somewhere between 80, 90, or 100 gallons per ton. And again, this is all theoretical because we haven't been able to produce it on a commercial scale yet. How many acres would it take? So you can see that, let's say at 4-ton yield and 80 gallons per ton, we need 47 million acres of land harvested for biomass. If we're up to, if you get as high as an 8-ton yield and you're at 100 gallons per ton, you know, this efficiency that Tom talked about, then we only need about 19 million. Where's the biomass going to come from? Where's the cellulosic going to come from? Well, everybody talks about switchgrass, right? Somebody said, you know, George Bush actually said the word switchgrass on TV, you know, in one of his speeches. The fact that George Bush could say lignocellulosic without stuttering was quite an accomplishment, too. But we're looking at things like macanthus, I can't even say that correctly, corn stover. But the point of it is, a lot of that is produced on land that we now feed cows. And now we're going to feed enzymes. And so there's some challenges there even as we go forward. As I said, we're tying back the cost of feed to the price of oil. How do we do that? Well, this is a very simple graph. The assumptions are at the top of the page there, 2.8 gallons per bushel. Operating cost of $1.75 per bushel. Capital cost of $75 per bushel. You get to sell the distiller's grains back. But along the horizontal axis there, we have price of gasoline. And this is wholesale, so before the tax is added. And then on the vertical axis is how much an ethanol plant could afford to pay for that corn under different scenarios. One is, the lowest one there is if they cover total costs, so the long run operating cost, and we don't have the government subsidies. We take away the blender's credit. The next line, the red line, the triangles are covering just the variable cost, but we took away the credit so they could operate in the short run without the credit. If we add back in total cost with the credit, and the very top one is the variable cost with the credit, you can see that Like right now, we're probably at about $1.50 wholesale gas price. If they had to cover all their costs without the government subsidy, they could pay about $1.50 for corn. Short run, keeping the doors open with the credit, which is what they have today, they can afford to pay about $3.50. Today, they're paying about $3.50 for corn in Iowa. What happens if gas prices go, let's say, to $3, much like they were last summer? Well, now, long term, they could afford to pay about $4.50, kind of that $4.40 number we saw earlier. Short run, they could pay closer to $7, which they did last summer. The point being, corn prices are tied to gasoline prices, which are a function of oil prices. That adds not only the higher price level, but the volatility. Now it's not just what's corn crop look like in Iowa this year, it's what's OPEC going to do to exports that feed directly back into feed cost. As I said, we get distiller's grains, obviously, from the production of ethanol. This is the supply of distiller's grains. I'm not sure. I know you have some plants out here, and certainly on the feedlot side, the dairy side, it's important. We feed some to cows as we winter them as well. But you can see we went from about 4 million tons a year. We're going to 40 million tons pretty quick. Excellent feed source. Fantastic stuff. But the trouble of it is the exchange rate, right? You put 56 pounds of corn in, you get 17 pounds of distiller's grains back. And yet I've had reviewed articles written by USDA and others that say distiller's grains are adding to our feed supply. Compared to what? Right? Compared to, ethanol but no distiller's grains, sure. Compared to no ethanol, I don't think so. But they are an excellent feed source, and with the policy we have, we need to learn to use them. They are getting cheaper, not in absolute terms, everything's higher priced, but they are getting cheaper relative to corn. If you put them on a percentage of corn price, that top line up there, we went from, early 2000s when they were primarily a protein source in monogastric diets, we were about 120% the price of corn. Now we're down closer to 90. So they are getting cheaper over time as that supply has increased. So in summary on the biofuels, ethanol and now feed prices are tied to oil. There's a new demand for corn and eventually for forage if the cellulosic comes to reality. That's going to lead to higher and also more volatile prices because even our forage prices now will have a linkage into the oil market. The renewable fuel standards, and this is a concern if you think about it, the renewable fuel standards set a supply target larger than our demand. Think about that for a minute. We use about 140 billion gallons of gasoline a year. If the entire market was E10, how many billion gallons of ethanol would we have to have? Not a trick question, right? I know it's early. About 14. How many do we have to produce? 15. And then we have to bring cellulosic ethanol into a market that's currently a higher cost to produce into a market that'll have a depressed price for ethanol because the supply is too large. How's that working for you? Okay. So that's why we have the debate now, an EPA open a public comment period on going to E15. We're doing tests on automobiles. Will they stand up? They're designed to handle E10. Can they handle E12? Can they handle E15? Can they handle E20? And with the stroke of a pen, if we go to E15, suddenly we have the demand that will drive the price higher on ethanol that will support higher prices of corn. Now, on the flip side, California has the low carbon fuel standard that comes in. It says, wait a minute, let's take a look at the carbon footprint of ethanol or any other fuel brought to the market. And so we're getting a big debate on what's in and what's out. Right now, under the California program, the indirect land use is important, which says that if Brazil or Argentina or other places of the world bring land into production and plow up grasslands or destroy forests that release carbon into the air, that ought to be charged against the ethanol that went caused the corn price to go higher in the first place. And then, of course, you have people on the other side arguing the other way. So that's a debate to watch. It'll be played out in the media. It'll probably be played out in Congress. It'll be played out. Ultimately, EPA makes the decision on those. So things to keep in mind. All right, let's talk about the economy. How many of you remember Earl Butz? Anybody? Yeah. He was once quoted as saying, it's better to be a mile from hell headed out than 100 miles out headed in. I think that pretty well describes what's going on in the economy. The trouble of it is, what's the latest fad in sports these days? It's NASCAR, and I think we just keep circling hell. All right? So what's it look like? Well, and you guys are all familiar with these numbers. You see them in the paper and hear them on the radio all the time. The gross domestic product in the fourth quarter was down 6.2%. They just came out earlier this week with the first quarter estimates being down 6.1%. Unemployment is the highest in history. In absolute terms, on a percentage basis, it's not, but it is at over 8%. Most economists think it could go as high as 10% before we turn the corner. Personal spending is down for the first time since 91. I'll show you some of this in a minute. And it's the biggest drop since 1980. And personal savings that were near zero are increasing. So what do we mean by that, and so what? Well, this is a GDP percent change. And notice over there on the far right, 6.2%. That was the fourth quarter. I don't have the announcement of this week on there, but it was 6.1. And I say it's the worst since 82. And you can see there was only two other periods where it was actually negative. So is it a big deal? Yeah, it's a big deal. Now, they were talking. In fact, they announced 6.1% decline, and the stock market went up. I can't figure out the stock market, but the point is that many people are beginning to think that maybe we have kind of reached a bottom on this. It may not get better soon, but maybe it stopped getting worse. Personal spending, personal consumption expenditures is important. And see, in the second half, the third and fourth quarter of 2008, they were both negative. If you go over here clear to the right, they were both negative. Biggest decline and drop since back in 1980. And notice that 1990 is the only other time they've been negative. Is it a big deal? Yeah, it's a big deal. I've never seen, and it surprised me, I don't have that much history, but it surprised me at how fast consumer spending shut off. I mean, people just stopped going. Cars are the most obvious thing. That you've heard the reports this week, sales down 40% from a year ago. So pretty dramatic change, pretty quick change. How many of you have a 401k or a retirement plan? Yeah, okay. The only good news about this economy is now all of us with a 401k know how a cattle feeder feels, right? See a third of your equity evaporate in about 3 months, okay? Personal savings. And this is one of those good for the goose, bad for the gander type of thing. This is personal savings as a percent of income. You go back in the 70s and 80s, as a society, we saved 8, 10, 12% of our paycheck went into savings. And by 2005, it was negative. We were borrowing to live. Now, that fueled the economy like crazy because we were spending it on restaurants and electronics and vacations and cars and all of that. But for about, two or three years there, we hovered around zero. But in 2008, we started savings again. We quit spending, we started savings. Good for the individual, have some personal savings, but it's really slowed the economy. So what? Particularly so what for beef? Well, we take a look at these four expenditures. Blue is food, pink is housing, green is medical, and the black is energy. They explain 53% of all the things we spend money on are kind of these, what you might call essentials or important items. Notice the blue one up there with the red circle around it. Expenditures on food declined in the fourth quarter compared to the year before. and compared to the quarter before. First time since at least 1970 we actually spent less on food than the quarter or the year before. Now, I don't think any of us are any thinner, right? That was a dollar amount. It wasn't a tonnage measure, per se. But that has implications for beef, because where do we sell a good portion of our beef? Food service, restaurants, particularly the high dollar end of things. And people quit going, slowed down. And that's had implications. So what, people still eat? Well, beef is the most expensive item on the menu, and we can all be very proud of that. It works in our favor when the economy is growing. It makes us vulnerable when the economy goes into a recession and a downturn, as we're in now. Food expenditures are down. The volume and the expenditures per trip to restaurants is lower. People are value shopping at the grocery store. Middle meats are down more than hamburgers. In fact, the first month of this year, tenderloins were down $2 a pound, and hamburger was up 20 cents a pound. People were turning down the steak, having meatloaf or a hamburger. The challenge is, you can't support a dollar fed cattle market on a dollar menu at McDonald's. We've got to get more value, more gross revenue out of those carcasses. If you take a look at the winter months, that's what I had available when I was writing this, December, January, February, compared to the year before. Prime minus choice narrowed 39%. Branded CAB, the upper two-thirds of choice, was down 57% compared to the choice. And choice minus select narrowed as well. Select came up, and we're all familiar with that one week that it was negative. Okay. The point being, people are trading down. Now, what are we doing about it? What's the government doing about it? I think you all have heard that they've pumped some money into the economy, right? The trap, or no, not trap, TARP. I keep getting those mixed up. Pumped a lot of money into the economy. The stimulus package did that as well. We've lowered the interest rates. This is the federal funds rate. If you go clear over there to the right, January, the interest rates, the federal fund rate was 0.15%. Now, they bumped it in February. It went up to 0.22. It's probably higher in March. But the point is, if you're waiting for interest rates to go down, I don't think I'd hold out a lot longer. But one of those take-home messages for you is, with this much money pumped into the economy, what do you think is going to happen with inflation? It's going to go up. When? I don't know. I'll tell you about a year after it happens. But the point is, at some point, we're going to have some inflation. And how do we fight inflation? We raise interest rates. The take-home message here, if you have a line of credit that has ballooned, first off, it means you probably were feeding cattle. But secondly, this is a good opportunity to maybe refinance that. Put it in a term note. Spread it out over 5 to 7 years. Because, and I know your rates have not dropped to zero, but they're probably lower than they're going to be a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. Personal spending is down for the first time since 91. Less spending even on food could lead to long-term frugal behavior. And I know we go round and round about this. I still remember my grandmother who came through the Depression, who, you know, had a farm, had land, is all paid for, but you open up a refrigerator, there'd be one spoonful of baked beans on a mayonnaise jar lid, because she never threw anything away. That society doesn't exist today, right? We throw away everything. Will we change? I don't know. Will we go back to restaurants as an eating experience, as part of our entertainment, and spend, who was it, Mohammed Kamari said somebody spent $220 on a steak the other night. I don't think that's happening real often. Okay. Interest rates we talked about. Okay, so what's this have to do with genetics? Well, brief history, and you guys understand all this. You go back to Hazel in 43, talked about using economic values and prices and cost in breeding indices. More recently, Milton and Collette talked about, the true measure, if you're making selections on genetics, is to run the net present value of every cow in the herd as you make these breeding decisions and discount it back. Obviously, prices, cost, and interest have an impact. More recently, Lazenby and others found that the changing the input and output prices did change the trait emphasis. And I want to focus in on that last one here for a minute. And this goes to your simplicity question, Tom. What's happened with cost? We know costs have all gone up. Fuel prices, particularly last summer, feed prices last summer, hay costs, land prices have doubled since 2003, even on pasture land throughout the country. But cattle prices have increased as well. So last summer, I'm sure even today, everybody's talking about we've got to chase efficiency, we've got higher costs out there, we've got to be as efficient as possible, and I don't deny that. But it wasn't too long ago, it's like, hey, we sell them by the pound, all we need to worry about is pounds. Well, when the price of those pounds goes up, and if you look at that, that runs from 85 up to about 2002, we averaged under $70 in the fed cattle market. We averaged under a dollar on calves. And yet, if you look from, 2003 to current, we were averaging, kind of the upper 80s to near 90. So our prices have gone up as well. So what's happened to the relationship? Very simplistic approach to think about here. If I looked at the steer corn ratio in the blue and the calf price, hay price in the red. So it's price of steers per 100 weight on live divided by price of a bushel of corn. On the calf, it's price of calf per 100 weight divided by price of a ton of hay. Right axis is calves, the left axis is steers. But the key thing to note there, if you look at those trend lines, those straight lines through there, is they're pretty darn flat. Okay? That price relationship over time has not really changed that much. And so the price ratios that were driving your genetic targets back in 85, it's the same price ratios driving your breeding targets today. Now, you could say, well, wait a minute. Here's a case where, we've got the price of corn going up and steers going down, and so we need to drive efficiency. Let's go out and really start chasing that one, and we get those animals selected. We find the best ones. We get ready to sell them to the commercial herd, and what happens? Oh, wait a minute. We're chasing the wrong dog. This is going the other way, and then back. My point being is that if we get caught up in the short-term economics when we're looking at long-term breeding decisions, and you guys understand this better than I, you as breeders at the top of the pyramid start making decisions that you then multiply, and it may be years before you get them to a commercial breeder who then is 3 or 4 years into a calf crop to get a calf crop, that's a long-term decision. And if I start chasing these 3 to 5 year trends, I'm going to have the absolute perfect animal at the wrong time. So we need to have a longer term view. What about competition against, and this would go more to the quality issue, but against chicken or against pork? Those relationships haven't really changed that much either. And I would argue in both these cases, whether it be on the cost side or on the revenue side, there's a reason why they're stable. Right? Economics work. If you go back up to this one, if the steer price is relative to the cost of gain is too low for very long, we start cutting the herd. Supply comes down, price goes up. Or if corn price is too high that drove that, we plant more corn and corn price comes down. It drives it back. Economics drives us back towards that mean, towards the middle. So long-term price ratios, I would argue, are relatively stable and thus more predictable than trying to predict individual prices. You go back to that net present value argument, and I don't disagree with it, but now you're plugging in prices for each of those costs. The price of the calves, the price of the feed, the price of the land, the price of the fuel, the interest rates, and now you're trying to predict each one of those. It's easier for me to step back and say, in the long run, these ratios are pretty stable. In short term, we can get out of balance, but let's let management handle that. What we implant with, when we start them on feed, when we sell them, what we feed them, how long we feed them, those are all short-term things to handle short-term price relationship, not a genetic decision. Okay, and there's economics reasons why we get there. So as you focus on your genetic goals, I don't think they've changed a lot from what they've been. Efficiency is still important. Product quality is still important. Management traits such as calving ease, docility, all of these things are still important. But we can get lost if you start chasing short-term price relationships. It may be driven by biofuel policy or federal fund rates and some of those types of things. I said progeny prediction is more accurate than economic prediction until I heard the talk yesterday, and now I'm beginning to wonder. But I'd still say it's probably true. A long-term relationship should be more of a compass than a roadmap. A compass in the sense of direction. Yeah, there's going to be detours from it, but don't look at those economic things as day-to-day, this is what I need to change in my breeding decisions. I do have a disclaimer about this. I probably should have started. There's probably more research needed. There's always more research needed. You pick a different time horizon, just as we saw, as you go to the short term, you get different responses. If you stretch that out longer, there's actually a little more slope in those lines. Okay. And there's other costs, obviously, besides feed. Also, the Lazenby et al. Article said that, you know, changing those relationships does change your emphasis. So the target is sensitive to price. My argument is it's just darn tough to predict what those price ratios are going to be when your progeny are in the commercial herd. Now, having said that, there's still reasons to be aware and concerned. Biofuel policy is increasing competition for feedstocks and land use for cattle. So we're going to be dealing with higher cost to gain, and that is bid back into feeder calf prices. So we may have a steady economic target for our genetic decisions, but a smaller herd. So there's still reason to be concerned, right? Monetary policy is impacting the value of the dollar. So we got inflation we talked about. And those are things you can think about financing now, refinancing now at these lower rates before they get higher. So with that, I'm going to quit. I'll turn it back over to Tom. Thank you.